You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, we're continuing our month of shows looking at the portrayal of medical practices and patient care in comics. In today's show, you'll hear a panel discussion recorded at last year's Graphic Medicine Conference in London, and Chair Paul Gravett is talking to graphic novelists Brian Fees, Philippa Perry, and Daryl Cunningham about their work. Brian is the author of the webcomic turned graphic novel Mom's Cancer. Philippa Perry, a psychotherapist herself, is the writer of the book Couch Fiction. And Daryl Cunningham, previously a psychiatric nurse, is the author of Psychiatric Tales. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. Resonance FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
We're battling on through this incredible day of encounters and discoveries, the dialogue between comics and medicine. And we're wrapping up over this next sort of 40 minutes with a nice discussion with three creatives who are working in the field of comics and dealing with medical issues. Three interesting, contrasting, differing approaches to comics. You've already met Brian, who gave a really tremendous presentation earlier this afternoon about his work, Mum's Cancer. And joining him are Daryl Cunningham, who is the author of Psychiatric Tales, and Philippa Perry, who is the author of Couch Fiction. And, I mean, all three of them are coming at this in quite different ways. I mean, we have, for example, a writer, in the case of Philippa, working with another artist, whereas both Daryl and Brian are complete auteurs who do the whole job. And in terms of the approach, of course, in one sense, both Philippa and Daryl are actually in the care system. Philippa is a psychotherapist, and Daryl, you're working in mental health as a nurse, is that correct?
I'm working mostly these days in elderly.
Elderly
dementia,
now, but at the time you were working in...
Yeah, well, I've done a varied amount.
Exactly, very much. Where, of course, Brian, of course, was very much from the family relative perspective. So we've got these different viewpoints of the whole thing. We'll just start off a little bit with Brian, but then give a little bit more attention to Daryl and to people who haven't had a chance to explain their work. And I want to open it up to you as well for some Q&A here. I think one of the things about the book, I suppose, I wanted to figure out is the process of making the stories while you were also going through the experience. Mm-hmm. That certain distancing, which were in a sense offers a sort of refuge from the realities, the harsh realities of what was going on. Was making a comic partly a way of stepping back from it?
Certainly, it was, and just in terms of process. Mom's Cancer was written and drawn in roughly real time, but about 6 to 8 weeks late. So something would happen, and I would get an idea, go home, write it down, do a little sketch, do
As
a little
said, it was
thumbnail.
It was very much word orientated, wasn't it, in terms of a journal?
Pretty much, yeah. I work that way. Other cartoonists don't. They're image first, but I generally do the words first. But at any rate, I would just capture that event, sit it aside for a month or two, and figure out how it fit into the story, because it was very important to me that Mom's Cancer be a story that had a beginning, a middle, and an end, even though I didn't know what it was going to be. But things like character arcs and things like subtext that wove its way through to the extent that I could and still be honest about what really happened. I didn't want it to just be a diary comic. Today we went to the hospital to have chemotherapy. Those have value, but that's not what I wanted to do. So.
Right. That meant imposing a bit more structure, though, presumably. This is why having that distance in time, developing it, and
the distance in time let me see what pieces fit into the story, and let me throw out a lot that didn't fit. I edited savagely on this, and I realized as I went that everything that didn't have something to do directly with my mother's story, it's her story, and if it didn't advance her story and tell her story, I got rid of it, no matter how much I loved it. So.
Which is, of course, different if you've been doing it much more directly and immediately, say, as a webcomic. I mean, one of my problems, my only real problem with webcomics probably is simply that there isn't an editorial sort of stage very often with them. They're just kind of out there continuously, and there's no kind of...
That's part of their charm and strength for some comics.
Can be.
in my case, I basically threw out everything that had anything to do with me whining, for example, about, yep. My hard life, because it's not my book, it's my mom's book.
Right, right.
I wrote it, but... And so there was... The time let me shape it into a narrative, and the editing let me focus it on what I thought the story should be about.
Mm, mm. In terms of the and we're not going to, I'm not going to pry about them, what your family didn't want you to get published. Presumably you drew it and then decided it shouldn't go from the web version into the book format. But I wondered, I mean, were there other areas that you thought you were thinking of something, I could have actually dealt with this aspect of this question, which has come up subsequently, where you realise that much as you've answered many people's questions, there were still others. And one that did occur to me that I couldn't recall whether you'd dealt with, which surely is something that is quite crucial, is simply the financial questions of insurance, of people being able to afford treatment. Is that something that was
not a problem
issue?
In our family. My mother had good insurance, and it wasn't an issue. It would have been artificial to try to shoehorn it in and deal with it.
It wasn't real.
It wasn't part of her story. That was not a problem.
Right, right.
The only thing I wish I'd done more about is the climax of the book. Because by the time the book wraps up, I actually title one of the last chapters Deus Ex Machina, because it resolves pretty quick. And part of the reason for that was I was just beat. I'd been doing this for a year or more, it doesn't look like a year's worth of work. It's a slim book, but boy, was I tired. And by the time I was done with the story, I just wanted to get it over with.
As we discussed earlier, that was part of that kind of cathartic release, and just wanted to be away from it, which perhaps also, I think you said some people don't always pick up on the actual ending of the book, the fact that your mother did die at the end, which you don't show, and which I suppose in theory you could have decided, I want to do an extra pages or do a postscript or something. You chose to do a text one.
We had literally 12 hours to decide what to do,
right.
And I think we decided correctly, but because I think the story is, frankly, just as a story, forget about my mother having cancer, I think it works whether she lives or dies, to tell you the truth.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's a story with two endings.
Mm.
There's the ending when she lives, and then there's the story of the page later when she dies.
Right.
We had a quick, tough decision to make, and I stand by it, but I wish we could have done better.
And I was wondering about the I know it was about your mother, but it is also about you and about your family and the process afterwards, the grieving process, the adjustments. Clearly, the story didn't end. I mean, there was a lot to deal with afterwards. Whether in fact that had ever been something you'd thought of. Not necessarily a sequel, but maybe an expanded version which you could have gone back to. Would you ever consider that?
I never felt I had anything unique or interesting to say about that. You know, everybody deals with death sooner or later, and there's a commonality there, and I didn't think my experience had anything to teach anybody.
Right.
You know, the reason to do mom's cancer is because I wish people had told me some of these things before.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have anything to say about, or didn't experience that with.
Right.
Death and grieving and the aftermath.
Exactly.
Just muddled through like everybody else.
I'm going to just that's very good of you, Brian. I'm going to come on to Philippa. Let me bring you in, Philippa, because what I love about the fact that you've done a graphic novel is that you told me that you were fairly new to the medium.
Brand new.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is also unusual coming from a publisher, Palgrave.
Palgrave,
who are not. Known for
they're
doing anything
academic.
Like this at all.
They're a branch of Macmillan's, but they're the academic branch.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I never set out to write an academic book. What I wanted to do was show people what I do all day. I'm a psychotherapist, and I'm also a psychotherapy client. So I do both things all day, because the time I started this book, I was actually in 3 times a week analysis as well. So I'm almost...
You've seen
like,
it from both sides,
yes,
as they say. Yes.
I've been a psychotherapy client or patient for on off 25 years, and I've been a practitioner for about 20 years. So I definitely see both sides, I think. And I wanted to show what it was like being a client, and I wanted to show what it's like being a therapist and the space between. And if you look at the space between, we've got a couch there, and it's couch fiction. There's something in that. I'm not quite sure what it is. But I wanted to show what I do all day, because it's very private. What happens is behind closed door. If you want to see what a fireman does, you know, there's documentaries, or you can follow one around all day. You can get to see what a fan does. But by its very nature, it's very confidential. And every relationship you have with, if you're a serial client like I am, every relationship you have with a different therapist or a different analyst is different. And every relationship I have with a different client or patient, you know, as a practitioner, is different. So I wanted to show a sort of typical therapy, and this is a fairly typical therapy, because I wanted to show what I did and what it's like. So basically, it was about showing off, I suppose. But the thing is, I'm not very good at it. I mean, I do my best at being a therapist, but I make lots of mistakes. And
so she's not some sort of a blackjack sort of super...
No, I'm afraid not. No, she's a sort of, you know, pretty ordinary psychotherapist. I'm a pretty ordinary psychotherapist. And sometimes she gets carried away with her theory and she loses the client in that because she's forgetting to track him. At one point, the client dissociates. She misses it. Oh. So, you know, she's a pretty ordinary therapy, but it shows how therapy can work in spite of and because of these misses. So it's what it's about. So I wrote my story, and then I thought, that's not enough.
So you wrote it as a
book? I wrote it as a
regular non-picture book.
No, I wrote it actually as stick figures. I'm not like Brian. I don't do the words first. I do the images first.
Oh, really?
Even though somebody else has eventually drawn them out for me.
Right.
Ah.
Had you designed the characters? Obviously, I know that the therapist is based.
Did stick figures.
Yeah.
Right. And then I took pictures of people. I'm a little bit like Pat, but I took pictures of the guy I wanted.
Uh-huh.
He didn't know.
So he wasn't one of your clients.
It wasn't one of my clients.
No breach of confidentiality.
No. And then when I'd written the story, I thought, there's more information that I can give to this. So then I did. So I've got the story, but then underneath
the subtext.
Oh, you can see on there. Underneath, I've put. So that's Pat, and that's James. And Pat has speeches and thought bubbles, and so does James. He's having his turn there. But then this voice underneath is mine. It's not Pat's. It's my voice. So I'm sort of commentating on what's happening in the action. So that's like another layer. And I'm explaining the theories.
It's a little bit like Rupert.
Oh, does Rupert do it like
that? Well, you do have a kind of text libretto, don't you, underneath?
Oh, you do, yes, I do. It's a long time since I've read my Rupert. I might go back to it. Probably an unconscious influence.
I think
on
perhaps.
Yeah.
Rupert's not therapy, then.
Oh, no, it's not.
Right.
So you've got that is another layer.
Exactly, yeah.
And then you've got the layer of the images and all the metaphors.
And you had planned out what the visuals were.
Yeah,
I sort of
drew a sort of cracked pillar. And she made it into a beautiful Doric column, you know. So,
and how did you link up with the artist?
Junko. Well, I found her in Loot. There used to be a newspaper before the internet called Loot.
I didn't know you could find comic book artists in Loot.
Well, neither did I, actually. But how do you go about these things?
You know, second-hand cars and things, but not... You know,
no, well, what I did is I put an advert in saying, very, very messy family need a housekeeper. Please apply in writing. And we got lots of awful people that were obviously... more in need of my service than I was for theirs. And then after about a week, I got a letter saying, my name is Junko. I'm Japanese. The Japanese are naturally tidy from birth. I will clean your house. Okay. And Junko has been brilliant for the last 10 or so years in attuning to me and what I need. She's a natural attuner. And she's also, my study does look a little bit like this actually, because I've got.
It's a whole new dimension. You have your.
That is my study, and I have
got
a lot of.
But you know all the furnishings and the cushions very, very intimately.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you?
And
the setting.
And these are all my books. And Junko is a very fast housekeeper. And then most of the time she's spent in my study reading. So she's very familiar with psychology and philosophy, and we have lots of conversations about... if I get a new book, she'll read it before I will. Then she'll give me a digested read, and I think, well, maybe I don't need to read it. So she's very much with me, and she used to be a product designer when she was in Japan, so she's had a sort of graphic design background and stuff.
Is that's a Flemish or Dutch name, the Graat?
Graat is, she's married a German man since she's been here.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's...
This must be the first, I don't know what the exact, but housekeeper...
You get promoted if you work for me, I tell you.
Oh my God, it's quite an amazing collaboration. So you brought Junko Graat into the
yes.
the project for Palgrave. Yeah.
She actually speculated that we'd get published and she'd get paid, which, mm-hmm. you know, that's pretty... brave of her.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand, she could do it when she was supposed to do it. Well, you know, it was thought she'd be doing the housework, but it's much better if I do the housework and she does the drawing.
That's the deal. Okay.
So it sort of worked
out.
So
now you need a housekeeper.
Yeah.
In terms of the impact of the book, as you say, you're hoping it's going to demystify psychoanalysis.
Well,
psychotherapy, I should say. I'm also just wondering, how can I put this? I couldn't help noticing as I read the book, the weeks going by, and the back of my mind there was always, well, this is going to cost quite a lot for this chap. He's a wealthy barrister, isn't he? He's got this kleptomania and childhood issues, which he does eventually resolve in the book. So and there's that whole question of having a story which does have a positive outcome, and also the question also of... The amount of time it takes for this to actually work, how you decide to convey
it's thought that psychotherapy causes change to happen on the levels of the brain, you know, forge different neural pathways, and that does not happen overnight. No. It's sort of like a way of thinking about it is that if you've learnt to make an attachment in a certain way with your primary caregiver, and that is somewhat traumatized or didn't work in some way, your brain does keep forming, and you can make another attachment with another type of caregiver later on. So it does take time. A year is bloody quick, but it's more poetic like that. Mm. But it probably take a bit longer in real life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes, psychotherapy private psychotherapy is very expensive, but worth it.
I hadn't pronounced that you were on both sides. You've been both a practitioner, but also a client, a patient, and you've experienced the benefits of it.
Yes, indeed. I'm so impressed by people like Fatima, who says she's 22 and she's up there and she's talking, and she knows everything. At 22, I would have been under the table going.
But
you are doing this now.
But I would have been doing it all the time. So you know, psychotherapy has really helped me to think maybe I can open my mouth a little bit. Maybe it's opened a bit too far now.
I couldn't help noticing fairly quickly about the paintings that keep changing.
Yeah,
so tell us about, because that's something you might not spot. You probably will.
In my
behind the sofa,
in my psychotherapy room, and in Pat's as well. You know, there are paintings sort of behind the sofa and, you know, around the room. And I was watching The Sopranos once, and Tony Soprano notices a quite an innocent picture in his psychotherapist's office, and he says, "You've put that there to spook me out, because look, the children are playing and they're ignoring this person, and that's what happened to me." And quite often people do notice certain things according to what stage their psyche is at. I mean, sometimes we go out for a walk and we notice the birdsong. And sometimes we notice the traffic, you know. Mm-hmm. It all depends what mood you're in. So you notice different things in the paintings. So the paintings sort of follow James's psyche, because they change from frame to frame. But the books in the bookcase, they follow Pat's psyche and what she might be thinking about, and what therapy and what ideas she may be drawing on. And about over halfway through the book, you'll notice that one of the bookcases is turned into a piano, which means maybe they're flowing a bit more, and she doesn't need a book so much.
Right, suggesting harmony and
maybe
make sweet music together, whatever.
Something like that.
Excellent. And the reception has been very positive to the book, hasn't it? We've got a great review in The Guardian, Time Out, other places have been
very positive about
Yes, I've had some fantastic reviews. Alain de Botton gave me an amazing review in the Times, which I was thrilled about. And people have been very kind, which is quite a shock, actually, because I wrote this book as psychotherapy as I sort of practice it. And I thought as soon as I sort of went, here's my book, people will go, oh, Philippa, we don't practice psychotherapy like that. You've got it all wrong. Because I have put stuff in this book, which is how I practice psychotherapy. It's a very personal tale.
It isn't an instruction manual, it's not from other books how to practice psychotherapy.
I've just done it how I do it. So I thought people would go, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, she's got it all wrong. But apparently other people do similar things. And this is how it is commonly practiced. So that was a little bit of a surprise to me, because it's a very private thing, as I said earlier, what goes on and what you do. So,
and for all, I mean, there is training, there are manuals, there are guides how to do this.
Oh boy, is there training.
But in the end, it's a relationship, and it's one-to-one with somebody.
It's
where we
could, two people in a room.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, that comes from something else, doesn't it? Two people in a room. I'm sure it does. Really? Like a film or something, doesn't it? You must know this, Alex. It's just two people in a room.
It's two people in a room.
My dinner with Andre.
That's what it was. Right?
Six people in a room, don't you think, really? Six?
Six? Well, maybe. In the back of the book, there is another layer to the whole thing, which is Professor Andrew Samuels.
Afterword.
He talks about the whole book and puts his thing on it. And he talks about... There is six people in the room, because there's your conscious, my conscious, your unconscious, my unconscious, my conscious talking to your unconscious, your conscious, and so it goes on. There's about 30 people in the room, because, you know, you all bring your ancestors in, and they're all having conversations, and it's going on all the time. Plus you're projecting other people you've met, and there's transference, counter-transference. Beautifully complicated, but I hope I simplify it to some extent without stupefying it.
Absolutely, and also I think you're using some of the, as you mentioned, with the background details of the paintings. There are techniques in comics where you can layer and embed extra information, isn't there?
There's an ongoing metaphor throughout the whole book, which is I don't know if you can see it. It's an island. And a sea and a sky, and there's a young James, the client's called James, and he's very young when he starts, and he sort of joins Pat on the psycho ship there, and they go off into another island, and at the end of the book there's a, oh, that's a torn copy, good thing I found it, at the end of the book there's this other thing where he's reached the other island there, and she's in a little rowing boat, not a sort of super speedboat anymore, and she's sort of paddling back while she's just in the sea, and he's waving goodbye from New Island. So what happens on New Island, I don't know, but I hope he has a nice time.
Great, thank you. Well, I want to bring Daryl in, if I can now, and talk to you, Daryl, about you had a similar... role, a similar sort of starting point to Brian, in the sense of putting your comics up on the web.
Yeah, when I started the book, it was some years ago.
Yeah.
So I did about half the book some years ago, sort of the early 90s, when I was actually working on the psychiatric ward.
So this is while you were still doing it.
Care assistant on a psychiatric ward, which went on for about 7 years or something.
And where was this again? It's in Yorkshire.
Chester.
Okay.
Down in Chester, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this was before the internet, and I had kept sending off chapters to publishers and nothing, basically. Mm. Although I got some good responses, but no one was willing to commit their arm, really, to it. Mm. And so I sort of filed it away, and then I started doing my nurse training, my mental health nurse training. And so it was still in the back. I didn't know what to do with it, really. And then after a few years, I realised that I just couldn't continue with this nurse training, basically, because I'd become completely burned out. And I had to leave the course, really, and just drop back to being a healthcare again.
Right.
And by this time the internet had come around, so I thought, I'll just stick some pages online, see what people think.
Mm.
And fairly quickly it started to get a big following, you know, from just random people all over the place. And Kenny from Blank Slate Publishing, a small publisher, UK publisher, said, oh, we'll like to publish these. I said, well, I'd need to do at least five or six.
You've stopped doing that, haven't you?
Yeah,
you've
I need to pick up again from where I left off.
Right.
So in about 9 months, I finished the rest of the book. And each chapter I put online, and each time I put it online, I got more and more hits, really.
So what kind of responses were you getting? Brian was talking about, were people identifying with your situation or with the patients you're looking after, the situations?
Any time I put on, like, say, the chapter of bipolar disorder, I'd get people saying, I suffer from this illness, and you described it exactly. And I think I'd only had, of all the emails I got, and I got hundreds, maybe one or two were negative.
Right.
Someone saying that I was making fun of people with this illness, which I'm clearly not.
No, people can be, some people can misread some people, things,
I think the gentleman himself was suffering from the illness. So I didn't respond to it because I couldn't tell from his email whether he was well or ill at the time of.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to get into that, really.
This could throw up problems. I mean, all three of you must be getting feedback, I imagine. You mentioned it, Brian, as well.
I have to be fairly careful because I could easily get into a big online discussion about things.
Right. And in terms of presenting yourself, I mean, I can't remember now, you don't name patients, do you? I mean,
I've not named the hospital or even the area of the country.
Right.
And I've tweaked various stories, given them other occupations, or sometimes I've changed the sex, and sometimes I've lumped people together.
And your graphic design is very, very interesting, I think.
I was at college in Leeds for a time, and Franz Masaryk was a woodcut artist who did entire kind of wordless novels.
One picture on a page.
Yes, fantastic. Yeah. Really,
in the 20s and 30s.
Black and white.
Yeah.
And that was a big influence on me, and that sort of filters through, really. You can still see that a bit.
Right.
In this. I went with black and white for this particular book because it simplifies things, and I think it's very powerful.
Yeah. The first part of the book, it tends to be these very dramatic, often quite traumatic cases, individuals' circumstances. But then with this particular episode, you decided to
see the jump.
Different.
Yeah.
The jump is
Exactly when I picked up again.
You came back into it.
After about 4 years, I developed with an artist. So the latter half of the book from this point is better drawn, in my opinion, than the first.
And this particular story also is less about cases, but I believe, but more about trying to overcome the stigma attached to
I want to talk
illness.
About famous people who had done well with mental illness, with various mental illness, and also those who had not done so well, but then had survived somehow anyway. I mean, in that chapter, I'm talking about Spike Milligan.
Yeah.
And in particular, he's interesting because people tend to think, oh, because he was suffered mania and the consequences of shell shock during the war, that this sort of comedy madness came out of that. But I tend to think that imagination was already there, and he was a talent despite the illness, not because of it.
Right, right, exactly. What I think is also important is that, of course, you're not just telling the stories dispassionately. You're very much involved. This is your job.
Yeah.
And you feel
a couple
very,
of these
very
things,
powerfully. And I think this is again why the story is as much about you as a carer, as a health, you know, as a nurse.
Yeah. Well, in my time I spent a lot of time. Obviously, I spent years working in mental health, and in that time, in all those years, within 1 month, I was very. Witnessed two suicides. One is a lady who hanged herself in the toilet. I mean, most all psychiatric wards they don't have any ligature points. You know, you can't curtain rails pulled down. There are no all the door handles.
They try to think of every eventuality, don't they? Yeah.
But this lady had been a cleaner in this hospital, and she knew it very well. So what she did, she climbed on top of the toilet, lifted a ceiling tile.
And there's wiring above the ceiling?
There was pipes. And she hanged herself with a dressing gown cord. And about a month later, a gentleman, it's related in the book as well, poisoned himself. He overdosed on furosemide, and he basically died while I was holding him. So we were waiting for the paramedics to arrive, and they, when he was in arrest when they came, and they couldn't be saved. Really. But he'd done too much damage to himself.
Yeah.
But that haunted me for a long time because I kept thinking, you know, as you do, what else could I have done?
Yes,
nothing actually.
But still, you can't help going over.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, and the last chapter, particularly, of course, is where you do talk about that. You had to make up your mind if you were going to tell this, because up to this point, it's been your experience, of course, but other people's problems.
No, I think.
And you decided to put your own story in.
Yeah,
as well.
I realised it was the way it had to end because I'd suffered. The reason why I left. Didn't finish my nurse training so I started to suffer really terrible anxiety, which led to depression. And basically, I just couldn't do anything really. I couldn't continue on the course. I had to leave because I was on as much medication as many as the patients on the wards.
Yeah.
And if a patient had come to me and said, "I'm all right, it's just this job is making me ill," I would say, "Well, change your job then."
Yeah.
But it's harder to do than you think, because having invested all that time in the training
and wanting to do it, wanting to help people,
couldn't. It took me a long time to untangle myself from it.
But it must have been. I mean, this is what we perhaps take for granted. We should never take for granted just the pressures on people like yourself in the health, mental health.
Yeah,
sector.
I don't understand how people can do it for year after year.
And in terms of how the work is going to be, it's being published here by a small publisher, but the wonderful news is it's going to be picked up by Bloomsbury, Harry Potter money, thank you very much, in America, and you're going to expand it a little bit, I believe, doing like a new cover.
They've asked me to do
a little bit more.
This is Bloomsbury in the US, they've asked me to just do an introduction, really to just sort of set it out for more for the general reader.
Right.
Even they don't really think it needs it, but it gives me a chance to do some a bit more artwork for it.
Yeah,
and I might push a small chapter in it if I've got space as well. I might expand it a little bit.
Right.
It depends really.
And what sort of reaction have you had? Reaction from people in the same field and people in the mental health?
Some people illness. I used to work with contacted me and said they really liked it, what was going on. But and especially the work I've done since then. I've done one medical orientated thing since then. I did a strip about the whole Andrew Wakefield MMR vaccine story. I basically covered it out in comic book form, and that's on my blog if you want to read it. And
How did you approach that? I haven't read that. How did you take that?
I basically just looked into it and read as much research as I possibly could on the subject, really. And there was much more to it than I ever thought. I mean, not just the fact that there was bad science at the bottom of it, but quite deliberate fraud involved and some very shaky stuff going on there. It was one of the reasons why he's been struck off. Andrew Wakefield, and since I finished that story, I now have to update it slightly.
right.
And that had an incredible impact on the net. I mean, when I first started my blog, it took me a year to get 3,000 hits or something.
That's a month, you mean?
In a whole year, it took me.
Oh, 3,000 a year. Okay.
Yeah. After I put that. Posted that Andrew Wakefield story, at 6,000 in 2 days.
Fantastic. Wow.
And it got picked up by Boing, Dig,
all sorts of
people.
Yeah, it's the power.
Because there's a big science sceptical community out there, really. And a lot of academic people emailed me and asked if they could use printouts and teach and stuff like that.
Great. And do you think the psychiatric test will also be able to have the...
I hope so. I mean, yes. Some people have also written to me about that. And people have written to when the book comes out, they're going
to
use it.
I've given it to my supervisees already.
Yeah, great. And, I mean, we've already covered that you've had people in Australia get in touch and use that. That's silly. This is obviously brings in a way to kind of round up with some Q&A now, but it is one of the underlying themes is the practical use of graphic narratives around medicine in treating patients.
Feedback I've got from the nurses that I used to work with, it's the book tells a really good, it's a good insight into the patients they're dealing with, and in when you try to do training for stuff like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or something like that, it's very dry, but this sort of goes into people's souls, really, a bit more.
Very much so. It also, I should have thought, would be something of a discouragement to read a trainee nurse to read your book, in the sense that it shows you the demands, what's really, really expected of you.
If they're in training, then they already know.
They already know what they're in for. I guess they do. I'm naively saying that. Yes, so it's real in that sense. Yeah. Let me open it up to the floor. Anyone would like to ask some questions? Oh, yes. Go ahead, Brian, please. I haven't brought you back in.
Daryl just said something in passing that struck home with me and might be of some interest. And that was, you said a small number of people wrote to you and criticized you because they thought you were making fun of these illnesses.
Yeah.
And I got that as well. I got a few emails from people who said, how dare you make fun of your mother dying of cancer? And I think that wasn't my point. But I think it's a fair reminder that there's still a significant portion of the population not in this room who think comics are supposed to be funny. And all they know about comics are the innocent little things they read when they were children, and they've never looked at a comic for the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. A place here where, people who accept that graphic novels can be about serious subjects, adult subjects, and about illness and things like this, we all talk to each other and we all get it.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes we forget that outside these walls are millions of people who don't haven't seen this kind of work, don't get this kind of work. And it's
they're looking for the punchline or expecting to be being sort of mocking or
it's
satirical.
It's an interesting kind of, I think there needs to be a gentle introduction of some of these things in the larger population, or at least just so much of it that
I think it might be certainly more of a problem in that, not a problem, but it's more your style has more in common with the newspaper strip tradition of an
that was deliberate as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas I think Daryl's clearly has got this starker black and white, quite serious kind of mouse-like or Persepolis-like graphics.
This is wonderful cartoon.
So it doesn't say funny, does it really? From with you, Philippa, I mean, have you had any feedback? Yeah, people saying, oh, you're just taking the piss out of it.
Actually, I've had really good feedback, and I haven't had, I'm expecting it any minute now, but I haven't had a poison pen letter yet.
Right.
But
not
so
yet.
It's going well so far.
Good. Let me open up because we're running over time a little bit. Anyone have some questions? Just hear from Ian.
Daryl, your stuff about Andrew Wakefield and the MMR fiasco, that sort of the flavour of kind of graphic kind of investigative journalism. And I wonder if do you see yourself going in that direction?
I'd like to do a whole book on sort of more controversial subjects like that. I'm working on one on homeopathy at the moment. Which is going to make me some friends and a lot of enemies.
Dare I ask if you're going to do psychotherapy?
No.
No.
You're welcome.
As I'm sitting next to a person who does
Right.
No, but I will be going. I mean, I'm thinking of doing more of a science-based book, and some of them will be medical, but other things will be things like conspiracy theories, like the moon hoax, supposed moon hoax.
Yes.
Which always infuriates me anytime I read it.
Yeah.
People could imagine it didn't happen.
Yes.
I wanted to ask if you, and I think you, for your author, would just talk about how you draw your comics. Could you do that? I mean, do you draw them full size or?
I'm an old school cartoonist, which means I still use paper and ink. The originals of these are 9 by 12 inches, and I don't know what that is metric, but about yay big. And so 1.5-2 times final print size. I actually drew them proportional to a computer monitor because I knew they'd be seen online. So
this is the kind of the new format for comics, isn't it now? The web, the monitor
and
format.
It was hard as heck to draw. I mean, the usual page format is a lot easier to divide into panels and so forth.
It gives you different...
I'm sure it is probably different. I don't draw them, but I'm sure it's different. But it also gives you different ways of laying out a page, which actually can be quite interesting too. You do some quite inventive layouts in the
Thank you.
That was hard.
So I use 2-ply Bristol board. I pencil in either blue pencil or very ordinary lead pencil, whichever. Ink it with India ink and brush, usually sometimes some crow quill, but I do 90% of my inking with a very small brush. Scan it, you know, and do quite a bit digitally. I actually hand lettered all of Mom's Cancer by hand on the page, but these days I have a digital font and I do a lot more digitally than I used to.
I'm fairly opposed to digital lettering in the end. I just think we can see, we know what typewriting looks like, and if it's a hand lettered font, as I'm sure you use.
This is my hand lettered font, and I made it myself. And the advantage I learned is that editing is so much easier. We had to do editing, and when you have to edit something with the writing on the page.
I know there's lots of reasons for doing it.
You know, you take the words up, and you've got to draw what used to be under there. You just can't edit. And translating into other languages, you know, there's a lot of reasons to go digital with lettering. I resisted too, but I'm a convert.
Okay. And Darryl, your process?
I'm sort of paper and pencil and pen. And then I basically take a cheapest photocopy paper, imaginable, and that size, and I'll draw out the frames, usually six or seven in this case, and then I'll draw the outlines, basically just the outlines in pencil, and then I'll ink them, then I'll put it in the scanner, and then from that point I'll start dropping in the actual solid blacks, and then the lettering is typed in. It's actually made from my own lettering. It's a font from my own lettering. So that's how I do it.
And is there much change from what's interesting to the actual composition? I know you were saying about the adding in a blast and things, but do you tweak it further?
I sometimes
on
do, because in some of the pages you can see they're thrown into negative.
So there's the effects you decide to do,
so
of course.
I'll try it to see what it looks like. If it looks stronger, we'll do it that way.
Right.
I mean, Photoshop gives you those options, which, I mean, before computers and that kind of thing, and when I wanted to do that, and I did used to do that, I would go to the photocopy shop and photocopy negative,
right,
and then cut it up and stick it on. Yes. But I can still do that now, but it's much easier.
And do you know how Junko's process?
We work separately but together, so I'll draw it, he'll draw it, we scan in, I'll work on it in Photoshop. And then it gets sent to Seattle, where Jacob Covey from Fantagraphics designs it and puts it together in the comic squares. Then it comes back to Junko again, and she puts it back in her two Pennyworth. Then I have another go at it. It's a long process, but I like working in a team.
And of course, in terms of the type is entirely your script, isn't it? That's
yes. Every word is on my words, but the pictures are, and the design and the layout is very much a joint effort.
Right.
And the font is Dupuy or something, Dupuy, something like that.
Uh-huh.
You'll know that. I see my job as just reporting as is. I don't see me as being, you know, say do it this way or that way or whatever.
At all, no.
Yeah.
No.
Darryl, and Brian, you're both more in hospitals, aren't you? So.
I found in the past that I used to work with a nurse who was also an artist, and she did a sculpture on the ward, it was like plaster and chicken wire kind of thing, and the patients were involved in making this, and it was an interesting thing, but it was a one-off. Basically, there was so much hostility from a lot of the staff about it, really. They just didn't get it, you know, they still know. I think...
is that attitude changing? Do people know, and maybe in the audience somebody knows?
I think it was just something outside their experience that they just didn't get, really.
Right.
Well, we've got people like Alain de Botton who are saying that architecture really affects the way you feel, and he's sort of campaigning for beautiful modernist spaces everywhere. They seem to think that will cure all our ills, which is great. So, you know, I'd love to learn flower arranging or something new, but you know.
In my experience, public art space is fairly common in U.S. hospitals, at least in California. I haven't spent a lot of time in other hospitals, but it's, I think it's recognized as something that improves the environment and perhaps affects patient outcome in that way. Personally, my approach to drawing these things is much like yours. I'm a reporter, you know. I approached it very journalistically and wrote what I saw or drew what I saw.
Paul, did you go to the hospital in France where Daniel Merlin Goodbray
But I've seen photographs of what he did, yes. This is a guy called Daniel Merlin Goodbray who's involved in an exhibition I'm doing this summer at the Pump House Gallery in Battersea Park called Hypercomics. One of his first hypercomics are like multi-path stories, which can also be not just virtual as in online, but they can be in a building environment. And in this hospital in Paris, he created a comic strip which could be kind of moved around, could be changed, and would create narratives past as you walk through the building.
Wonderful.
And very, very avant-garde, interesting idea. And it was a commission from a Paris hospital, a very far-sighted one. Well, I know we do have, I think, hospitals. I know there's, is it St. Stephen's in London that's on the Fulham Road? I know that's
Chelsea Westminster has art exhibitions.
Yes, there's a lot of hospitals do have them now, and one would hope that that's a trend that could expand.
Newer ones, exactly,
make room for art, don't they? But that's not necessarily art by patients, though. One could imagine
no,
that's...
No, and this is commissioned as your friends of the hospital, charity funded.
I mean, does anyone know more about programmes for patients making comics, making art?
Well, I saw an exhibition of cartoonists at the hospital in Walthamstow, actually.
Oh, right.
No, I wasn't going there for the exhibition, I was visiting the patient. I was surprised.
One would have thought there is potential for this to be developed. I mean, especially Matt being in the three of you at some stage and having had your experience with that. Some more questions?
Weren't you asking whether they play into different stereotypes by
Yes, you did mention this, the whole portrayal of
The asylum, for example, is it always going to be this iron bed with the bars and Victorian architecture is quite imposing. So
well,
what extent do you have to use those kind of signifiers to be able to set the scene?
I have in this book simply because that's what the hospital looked like.
What you experienced.
And I
yes.
couldn't not do it any other way. Mm. And after the events, had many of things described in it, they actually built a new hospital nearby, and the other hospital has been demolished. The old Victorian hospital has been demolished. So they've got this brand new box like building, really, with not much character, really. But the thing is, yes, the old asylum buildings could look very forbidding, but they often were surrounded by beautiful parks, and they had big theatres inside them, you know, they had, you know, with stages, where, you know, ballrooms and tennis courts and all
that's
sorts
true.
Of stuff.
I mean, the hospitals were built to be like church-like, because
they
were supposed to inspire you, but they've come to have all these negative connotations.
Yeah.
I mean, the Museum of Modern Art in Dublin used to be a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
The Imperial War Museum.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? How beautiful the Maudsley is.
It still is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ironic. So, on this topic, I'd just like to mention, there is a hospital that's called the Evelina Children's Hospital, which is right next to St. Thomas's Hospital near Westminster. And it was designed by children because it's a children's hospital. It took a lot of money, but it is actually the best children's playground ever. And they have this magnificently tall slide, and they have all these interactive games, and they have a library, they have a canteen for children, and it's because children don't know that they're really ill. They don't really comprehend that they're in a difficult situation. They know they're sick, but they just take it as it is. Whereas an adult's kind of whine about it. I liked how the hospital incorporated that need for children to feel like children, and I think that future hospitals should incorporate what adults need as well, not just this box area. We should have a bit of fun too.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Fanny.
Thank you. Welcome, Fanny.
If any American listeners enjoy today's show, this year's Graphic Medicine Conference is taking place right now at the Feinberg School of Medicine, Northwestern University, Chicago. And more info about last year's conference and this year's conference can be found at graphicmedicine.org. Panel Borders was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch. And on next week's show, I'm talking to cartoonist Ross McIntosh about his graphic novel, Seeds. And that's at the same time, 5 p.m, Resonance 104.4 FM in London, with a podcast at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.